dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers. To the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, hitting firewalled hoe. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me do my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. To CG, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RAMs, SIPs, SIPs. Dedicated to the hackers and...
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio. I am Stank Dog. Today is January 11th, 2005. Coming to you on another Tuesday, episode 78, did I say that already, 78, of Binary Revolution Radio. And tonight is going to be a really, really great episode that I'm looking forward to personally. I'm going to learn something. I know a lot of the listeners might not think that's possible, because I'm a little bit slow, but I'm going to learn something by the end of this, because I'm going to ask the most baseline questions to my co-host tonight, the code expert herself, Ilanka. Thank you for being on the show, Ilanka, and welcome.
Hi, glad to be here co-hosting tonight.
Ilanka, of course, is the famous cryptography expert, if you will, for her work on Kryptos and the Cyrillic projector being the most noteworthy and presented at DEF CON and things like that. And we actually are going to burn through some emails here quickly off the top, some housekeeping stuff, so that we can get into my questions, because I've got a lot of them, quite frankly. This is a topic that I freely admit that I do not know much about. I know what I've read, and I can speak about what things I've heard in the news and what breakthroughs and things like that. But if you set something in front of me and said, here, figure this out, I would just stare at you like I was, like I did, you know, probably the ugliest blank stare you've ever seen in your life.
I do a lot of that myself, so don't feel bad.
Okay. All right, well, then let's do our email first. Let me play our email theme music here.
Radio@binred.com.
Okay, and our first email this week, I'm going to start with one I was expecting from our good friend Pixel Fiend, a longtime listener, a longtime friend of the show. And Pixel Fiend, of course, gave me the information I was asking about last week. Last week, somehow, I went off on this tangent, which I'm very, very apt to do quite frequently, and went off on this tangent about a game show that I remembered, and I wasn't sure exactly the name of it, where they had the I don't know if they called it Bachelor and Bachelorette, but they had the contestant on the left.
Yeah, Bachelorette 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, well, see, it's perfect timing then. Yeah. So I couldn't remember if it was the dating game or not the newlywed, but there was, I didn't know which one it was. So Pixel Fiend says, Stank, you were thinking of the dating game, 1965 to 1973.
Oh.
Also, on that same show, I also made a joke about Tootie, which was actually, that was a joke because someone's handle had the number 2 and then the letter 7, and I asked, do you think that's a reference to Tootie? And, of course, Tootie, for those of you who don't know, was played by Kim Fields. Kim Fields was Dorothy Tootie Ramsey on The Facts of Life, 1979 to 1988, and yes, I'm ashamed to know that, says Pixel Fiend. Now, first of all, don't be ashamed. Come on, Pixel Fiend. We're both in that age bracket where we can remember this kind of stuff. I'm very proud to admit that proud, maybe not the best word. Proud, no, but actually maybe ashamed is a better word to know. But yes, I watched The Facts of Life there. I admit it. There's your breakthrough announcement on Binary Revolution Radio 78. I admit it. I watched The Facts of Life.
What I want to know are, what are the shows today that 10 years from now people are going to be embarrassed to admit watching?
Oh, my goodness. American Idol. which I frankly still like, and I get a lot of email flack from that. Flack from my friends. Dual Parallel always tells me about that. I like that too, and I'll be ashamed to admit that in 10 more years.
My favorite reality show has got to be Amazing Race. I can't get enough of that one.
See, and now here, I think we might have. I don't know if you know this. I'm a reality fan, reality TV fan myself, but only when there's like an adventure or a challenge of something going on. If it's some reality, who wants to marry this, who wants to sleep with that, who wants to date this, you can take all that stuff and throw it in the ocean. I can't stand that, The Bachelor and all that, but I love The Amazing Race and Survivor. Do you remember a show called The Mole?
Never watched that one.
The Mole, that was one where it was like one of the 12 contestants was a plant. He or she was not a real contestant. Their job was to fit in with the contestants. They were a mole and make the contestants lose, but try not to be obvious about it. And the way that people got voted off at the end of it was you had to guess who you thought the mole was, and you'd write the name of who you thought the plant was, and they had a number of questions to describe them. Whoever got the most wrong got kicked off, because you probably were thinking the wrong person was the mole. So that was an interesting show. So stuff that has some adventure and some excitement and chasing and stuff like that, I like.
Okay.
All the romance stuff, yeah, I can pass on that. I love The Amazing Race. Great show. But see, maybe we should go on that, Alonka. Maybe you know I should go on there. But my problem with that show would be, A, I'm not eating or drinking all that nasty stuff.
You handle the eating things with jumping from great heights, and I'll do the rest of it. Those two, I think, would give me a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I wouldn't be anxious to do the great heights, but I could do it, I think. But the eating and drink, no, that's not going to happen. If it's not a grilled cheese sandwich, no, keep it away.
did you watch the recent episode with the, I think it was a Hungarian spicy soup?
Yes, I did see that one.
That was rough.
Yeah, personally, I think I might be able to drink some of the nasty stuff. Like, they had to do that weird Chinese tea one time. I don't know, I might be able to do that, but I couldn't eat some of the eyeballs and whatever they were eating sometimes.
Or the one where they had to eat those kind of seafood, they chopped up an octopus and they had to eat the tentacles while they were still squirming.
Oh, that's not happening. That's not happening. And that's why, you know, one of the shows I hate is that Fear Factor.
I do not watch Fear Factor because the stuff they make people eat is just way beyond the bounds there.
Yeah, that's not Fear Factor. That doesn't show any sign of fear. That's Gross Factor.
Yes.
And I don't really need to see that. That's ugh, gross. Anyway, yeah, that's what it'll be. Now, see, and to go back to embarrassing shows, when I came home from school when I was a kid, like in middle school, I came home and I would watch The Facts of Life, and I loved it. It was a cool show until they put George Clooney on there. They started working and owning that store and stuff like that. And Miss Garrett was gone and all that stuff. Then it started to stink. But I would watch The Facts of Life. Well, it was Different Strokes would come on first. And then The Facts of Life. And then Silver Spoons. And seems like there was something else. I don't remember what it was. But there was that was my after-school lineup for the longest time.
And this was when you were about how old?
I was in middle school. So I was probably, oh my gosh, I'm dating myself here, Alonka. You're putting me on the spot here. I was probably probably somewhere around 9 to 12, 13, 14, somewhere in that range.
See, and I think that's normal for humans. I think we have that age when we're kind of like in our teen years, and the shows we watch and we think, this is the greatest thing we've ever seen in our entire lives, and we maintain a soft spot for it for the rest of our lives. But often I've gone back as an adult and looked back at shows that I thought were just the best writing ever, and I look back at it and go, I thought this was good writing.
Yeah, some of them.
And it's something about that age, I think.
Yeah, some of them hold up surprisingly well, but yeah, I don't foresee anybody reminiscing about how great the Power Rangers were, for example. I don't see that happening anytime, or SpongeBob. I don't get the whole SpongeB obsession either. But anyway, we went off on a tangent there. But yeah, I watched I have to admit, The Dating Game, maybe the reason I didn't remember it so clearly is because that predated me. I have to admit, that was before my time. I watched it in reruns or whatever when I was younger, but I don't think I was around when that was first in its prime, so to speak. That was probably he mentioned it was 65 to 73, and I'm certainly...
That's like around the original Star Trek and Bewitched and Dream of Jeannie. I remember things were just switching over from black and white to color, but I think The Dating Game was all in color, as I recall.
Yeah. that was a little bit before me, frankly. So, and actually, let's get back on tech here, because Pixel Fiend also gave me some good information, not only the correcting me on my reminiscing there, but he also went on to follow up on the voiceover IP PDA discussion that we've been having for a while here. A lot of people are really interested in being able to use your PDA for voiceover IP applications and being able to use your PDA phone with built-in Wi-Fi as a cell phone without having to pay cell phone coverage and stuff like that. Link it back to an asterisk box, et cetera, et cetera. So Pixel Fiend also says, quote, "Anyhow, just to add to the VoIP PDA emails, I posted a link in the forum a couple of months ago to a story that is good enough to mention again. It's one of the I Cringely column from PBS.org on Andrew Grieg, and I hope I'm pronouncing that properly, Andrew Grieg, who works for Starnix, a Linux consultancy firm in Toronto. It outlines all kinds of wonderful things he's doing with Asterisk, Myth TV, etc., and runs it all via his Zaurus SL6000, which is a great, great little PDA. Here's a quote from the article where it mentions the ultra-cool Wi-Fi cell asterisk phone setup he has for the Zaurus. And this is a quote from the article. "Walking around in his house, the Zaurus, equipped with a tri-mode communications card, is a Wi-Fi VoIP phone running through the Asterisk PBX and connecting to the Vonage Voice over IP network. Walking out of his house, the Zoric automatically converts." I hope this is so cool sounding. "The Zoric automatically converts to the local mobile phone carrier, though with a data connection that still runs back through Vonage. At Starbucks, it's a Wi-Fi Vonage phone. At Andrew's office, it is a Wi-Fi extension to the office Asterisk PBX and to Andrew's home PBX. That's one PDA doing the job of two desktop PCs, a notebook PC, and three telephones." That's speaking of Star Trek. That's straight out of Star Trek to me. "I'd love to do something similar with my SL5500, but it doesn't have the built-in capabilities that the SL6000 has, microphone, Wi-Fi, etc. Naturally, there are ways around some of the shortcomings, which I'll be checking out in the nearer future. Thanks for all the hard work you do. Hope you get some sleep, young man. I'll be listening." Yeah, I was a little tired last week on the show, too. I think it came through. That is such a cool story. I mean, honestly, one little PDA. Do you have a PDA, Alanka?
I've got a couple, yeah.
Okay, and do you enjoy, I mean, do you find them handy?
It depends. Sometimes yes, sometimes I find they just don't hold up to the abuse that I put them through. Right now, the handheld that I'm playing with all the time is my iPod. I just won an iPod at a Christmas party, so I'm wishing that the iPod had the functionality that my old like Palm VX did. They're not there yet.
Well, yeah, I think actually there's a lot of people working. I think there's a Linux port over to the Palm or over to the iPod right now. I think that I don't know if it's completely working and functional, but I know there's some stuff being done on it, so definitely something to watch for.
Okay, all right, thanks.
This is just such a cool story to me, and I found the link. It's a little bit long to read on the air, so I went ahead and Tiny URL'd it, which is such a great tool. And the Tiny URL is 64LDG, as in Larry Doug Gordon. For easier access to the listeners that are listening live, those of you who are getting this from the archives, hopefully I have the show notes up quickly with the direct link. And this is just so cool on so many levels, because this is a proof of concept that it can be done. You know, people can sit on Slashdot all day. I love Slashdot as much as the next guy. People can sit on Slashdot all day and talk
or
about...
Or girl.
Huh, I'm sorry?
Or girl.
Boy, oh, I'm sorry, what did I say? Okay.
As much as the next guy or girl.
Oh, okay, there we go. There's my politically correct check for the show. as much as the next person... gender neutral, that anybody can sit and talk about, oh, you should be able to do this and you should be able to do that. Wouldn't it be cool if you could do this? But you know what? He did it. This is a proof of concept that it can be done. And cable companies, phone companies and all this, they have this monopoly. They have physical monopolies, government-regulated monopolies. You don't really have a whole lot of choices. As much as they try to claim you have alternatives, you really don't have feasible alternatives. They set these prices, and now people are going to start seeing that they're not justified. The same thing happened with the cost of CDs and music. People started realizing, well, wait a minute, how come I can burn it at home for a few cents, for a dollar maybe, but you want to charge us $20 for a CD. People are going to start learning that it doesn't cost as much as these companies are claiming, and this is going to start happening. And this man is the first one to actually sit down and do it. One person who had the time and the resources to sit down and do this, and is a potentially an open source project, that's phenomenal. That is just a phenomenal accomplishment, and this guy deserves just all the credit in the world for that. Now, again, he works for a company now. He has some resources. This is not just one guy. He has some resources to help him out on that. So setting all this up by yourself at home, frankly, the time issue is something that I wouldn't have and a lot of people wouldn't have. But having the time and having a reason to do it for your company and stuff like that, and that he's sharing it with his neighbors and the rest of his community is also living on this, I mean, this guy deserves a pat on the back. That's really, I mean, I want people to go to this article and read it. Again, it's tinyurl64ldg. Read this article. This man made it happen. That's just one quote that I read out of the very long article with lots of eye-popping stuff that make you just say, wow, it can be done, and it's only a matter of time before we get it. And for one, I'm looking forward to it. I don't have cable. I don't watch, you know, I have basic 10 channels or something like that. Because I refuse to pay these overblown costs. It's not worth it. It's just not worth it to me personally, but hey, that's personal choice, I guess. And Pixel Fiend, you, my friend, are one of the few people that can call me young man. You do realize that, right? I give him a little bit of liberties on that one. Usually I'm the old guy. I'm the old man. So, Pixel Fiend, thank you for the email. You know, we always like hearing from you. So, we have one other email today from one other email that I'm going to read from, help me out with this one. I'm going to go with Sekel. Sekel?
I'd say Sekel too. But
Sekel.
That's a guess.
Okay, Sekel, Sekel. Who says, I am listening to some of the old episodes on my iPod. Hey, look at that. See?
Okay, there we go.
What a coincidence. See how things work out? On my iPod. Actually, just started listening because of the iPod, but that's neither here nor there. I heard you mention a book called Terror Cell by Eric Giles. I did some research but cannot find anything anywhere, including TerrorCellBook.com, that is the correct URL of the official site, about when this book is going to be released or available for order. I was just curious as to curious if you might have any updated information about it or might know when its project release date is. Now time for the smoke. I enjoy listening to the show, the forums, the websites, and Hack TV. My boss tuned me into you guys when he handed out copies of Hack TV on CD for all the employees here in the tech department. Feel free to use my real name or online moniker in emails. I post or answer to both. Well, we'll use your handle. I don't give out real names on the site. That's interesting that your boss handed out copies of Hack TV on CD. That's interesting. I wonder why. I wonder what the motivation to that was. Interesting. Okay, now, how long have you had your iPod, you said? You got it for Christmas?
Yeah, it was at a Christmas party. There was a trivia contest at a Christmas party that I won, and I got to pick any present under the tree, and I picked the iPod.
All right. Have you got into podcasting at all? Because I know that's the big craze that's taken off with the iPod.
I have not. I've kind of heard the term here and there, but haven't played with it. Lately, I've just been importing every CD, going through every box and every shelf and every CD I own and getting them all imported into iTunes and going from there and rediscovering music that I bought like 10 years ago that I haven't listened to, and now I'm falling in love with it again, like Mozart's Piano Sonata in D Major for Two Pianos, number 448. I cannot get enough of that piece.
Very good stuff. Very good. I wonder if that's... I wonder what the copyright rules are on some of that stuff. Maybe I could close the show with that sometime. Probably still...
I love it. It's Einstein loved the piece as well. It's just a dialogue between two pianos going back and forth, and it's great. It fills my mind. How's that for a quote?
I actually do. I like some classical. I play piano. Not well, but I can play piano. I took lessons for a few years when I was a kid, so I have some appreciation for that kind of stuff. It's very good for what I call white noise music. Something to listen to while I'm working or typing or hacking or whatever. I like to have some nice silence. Something that doesn't distract me, but is soothing, you know?
Actually, there is a project that I have that's related to this piano sonata that your listeners might be able to help with.
Okay.
While I was listening to the piece, I was saying, you know, I would love to see this thing played live and see the two pianists going back and forth. And I'm trying to think, I live in St. Louis in the Midwest, and I'm wondering, somewhere online there must be a database that says, here's where all the live performances of the following Mozart pieces are going to be in this following section of the United States. And I've been unable to find anything like that. I mean, I know I can go to the St. Louis Symphony site, and there's probably a Chicago Symphony site, but I don't know if there's any kind of a master database. So if any of your listeners have ever heard of something like that, can tell me where I can go to hear this piece played, I would really appreciate that.
And of course, they can email us here, radio@benrev.com, or they can email you directly with that?
Sure.
At? Which address would you prefer?
Either one's fine. My website is Ilonka.com. My easiest email address to remember is Ilonka@AOL.com.
Okay.
That's Elonka.
All righty. So if anybody has any information on that, and you know what, if it's not out there, that's a good project to start, you know. That'd be a nice thing. It might take some maintenance, unfortunately, but maybe somebody would be interested in that. So by
all means.
It'd be
a challenge.
Yeah, exactly. A challenge. So let's see. Anyway, yeah. So podcasting in general, of course, is just basically an XML feed, but instead of feeding news, it's feeding music or links to music. And when you what do you call it? Cradle your iPod when you put it in there and connect to your Mac. Anything that you're any of those podcasts that you're connected to, it'll download those MP3 files into your iPod so you can listen to them. So, for example, we have an iPod of the show that people can connect to, and that's benrev.com/radio/podcast. And when they do, when we put a new show up, when they cradle it, it'll automatically download it to their iPod. And a lot of people, you know, have started picking up on us from that. They'll get each episode of the show once we put it on the podcast, and they'll pick it up and listen to it on the way to work the next day or something like that. So it's definitely a great tool as far as getting independent and underground and new radio talk shows. And I won't rehash my thoughts, but I think everybody, the regular listeners, know how I feel about the internet still being the only form of true free speech and unbiased media. I'm sure there's some bias too, don't get me wrong.
There's plenty of bias on the internet.
I'm not saying that it's all unbiased, but I think it's the last bastion of free speech that people can say what they want without the FCC cop stopping them, without advertisers manipulating and influencing them, et cetera, et cetera. But again, yeah, I'm not going to go into that again. So anybody that's listening on an iPod or on our podcast, and I'm sure we're carried by other podcasts like Hacker Media and stuff like that, please, I'm glad that you've listened to a show. I hope you like it and listen to more. But if you did pick up like this gentleman did, or this person, I should be gentleman, this person, Sekel did, that's pretty a neutral name also. I can't really, yeah.
This listener,
yeah. I'm trying to figure out by the name. If it would have been like Mr. Sekel or something, that would have been, but... write in and let us know, just for the curiosity factor. If you found out about Binary Revolution Radio through some podcast or some podcasting channel, write in and let us know, radio@benrev.com, just for the curiosity factor. And let me know if you think about it, if you hate it or you like it or whatever. Most people, I know there's some podcasts, of course, some sites have mentioned us. The only advertising that we really do is... We don't do promotion. We don't do advertising. Everything has been word of mouth. The only thing we do is, like, we go to some hacking conferences and stuff like that. We'll pass out free CDs at the hacking conference or at the 2600 or different hacking meetings and stuff like that, Linux user groups and things like that. Other than that, we've never done any kind of advertising. We don't put an ad. There's a thing in the back of 2600 in their classified section, which most people probably don't even look at, that's been back there the whole time. And that's just a general thing about Binary Revolution, just BenRev.com in general. So other than that, we really don't get a whole lot of stuff. It's just when people come across it and tell their friends and they add it to their sites and people give us mirrors, which is great. So it's very much, you know, I'm very proud to say that it's a community thing. The community has embraced us and helped us out, and we appreciate that. So the fact that podcasts are taking off and spreading that much further, it just makes us that much more accessible. I think that's really, really cool. Now, about Terror Cell, which was the main point of the email, when I got this email from Sekel, again, I apologize, whichever one's wrong, I contacted Eric and to see if he had any updates for me, and I actually have gotten some updates, Ilonka, since I spoke to you. And actually, I'll just let me just read his response. He's Eric Giles says, as far as an update, my agent tells me that he's gotten the manuscript in the hands of some of the top publishers who handle other folks, some other famous folks. And though none have picked it up, they all had very good things to say when they declined it. And these guys are top of the list. They don't, if they don't like something, they have no qualms about saying how much something really stinks. So they're complimentary, they mean it, but so far, it's still unpublished. So, that's it from him. Unfortunately, I don't have any better news to say that it's out there yet. However, I do have some good news for you. I still have one pre-release copy, signed by Eric Giles, that he had sent me to give out to our listeners. I have one left, and he wholeheartedly supported that I send it to you. So if you want to send me your real name and address, I will be glad to pony up some coin and send this to you as thanks for listening to the show and thanks for writing in and supporting us in general. I'll be glad to send you this. It's a thick, complete book signed in the inside front cover and dated pre-release copy by the author. So contact me with that information, the same address, and I'll get it out to you as soon as possible. Now, let's do a quick show-and-tell section of the show and talk about some of the stuff. I've got a quick one this morning myself. Saturday was my local DEF CON meeting, DC 305 meeting.
Actually, by the time this airs, it's not going to be yesterday, right?
No, it's going to be it's Saturday. We pre-record the show, of course, and everybody knows that. So on Saturday was my DEF CON 305 meeting, so that went really well. We're starting, it's kind of a new meeting, and we're getting together, and it was pretty much a organizational meeting, deciding, you know, we have a new meeting location, introducing people, talking about some of the things we want to try to accomplish, some of the group projects we want to work on, and things like that. So started off very good, so that's a very promising start to hopefully get a lot of people learning and working on projects together for South Florida, 305, of course, being Miami. And other than that, I spent a little bit of time making some corrections to DocDroppers. Of course, DocDroppers, of course, is our document repository site that we announced last week, Black Ratchet and I, DocDroppers.org, and there is an RSS feed for the site that shows all new articles. There is a little bit of a bug with it, however, and it's kind of a Firefox rendering bug, if you will. If you click on the RSS feed in Firefox, you'll get an error message. It does not look correctly. However, it does actually work. If you go to FL2600, which is my local 2600 meeting, you can see it in action there. It is actually working. You can embed it in your sites and have a list of all the most recent articles and everything. It just won't, if you click on it in Firefox, it doesn't quite render properly right now. And we're working on it. We're going to try to come up with a little customized version, a little better version of it anyway. There might be an upgrade we can put on there that'll help that out, but we are looking into that. But just so people know, it does actually work. You should be able to successfully put that into your sites right now and have it working. It just might not let you click on it right now. So we're looking into that. So that's really what I've been spending my time working on the past week. Now you, I don't guess we can probably talk about the last week because your projects are a lot more ongoing. You don't have week-to-week projects. You have month-to-month and year-to-year projects going on. So why don't you share some of the stuff that you've been working on that interests you and share with the listener some of the stuff that you've been working on.
Okay. The big projects right now are all code-related, at least in terms of my hobby projects. I also have my day job. I'm a game developer. And I'm also volunteering a lot of time to the IGDA, the International Game Developers Association. I'm on the committee that covers state of the industry white papers on the state of the online game industry. So we did a white paper on the state of the web and downloadable games industry and another white paper that we just released about persistent state worlds, and those are all on the igda.org/online website. They're free to download if anyone wants to take a look at those. Codes, I've got web pages on all kinds of things related to cryptography. Probably my most famous web page is about Kryptos, which is the sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters, and it's also famous right now because there are some very mysterious references to Kryptos on the book jacket of the Da Vinci Code. So I'm getting about, I'd say 600 to 700 unique visitors per day that are coming to my site just because they're researching the links there. I'm also maintaining a website on famous unsolved codes And so I'm always kind of surfing around and looking for stuff on that. And doing a lot of public speaking. So I volunteer to local schools. Like I think next week I'm going out to a local high school to be speaking about unsolved codes and cryptos and a code, famous code that we cracked called the Cyrillic Projector Code. I think that's something that's coming up later in your show tonight.
Yeah, I think we're probably going to all of those topics a little bit more. And
okay.
I think that's great, by the way, the high school. I didn't know you were going to spring. That's very noble. Do you get good feedback from that, from the high school students?
Oh, it's great all the way around. I love talking about the codes, and they love the kinds of things that I'm talking about. And often I get ideas from them, new avenues to explore maybe. And I'll talk to anyone about a code that I'm trying to crack. Definitely I'll talk to people that have, like, the college educations and stuff, but I'll talk to teenagers. I'll talk to little kids because they may be thinking about things in a different way, and they're going to see something or come up with some idea that no one else has. And I'll go, oh, a stair-step pattern. Okay, I'll try that. And maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. But I love getting ideas from as many different people as possible.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, that's, you know, and that's the hacker mindset. It really is, you know. Definitely. Now, you said, when you say public speaking, what about, I mean, I think most of our listeners anyway probably know that you presented at the most recent DEF CON, correct?
Yes, I've spoken at DEF CON and Freaknik, and there's a big convention down in Atlanta called Dragon CON, and I speak there every year, both on codes and on my day job on the game industry. And I've spoken at several universities. I was just speaking at Washington University recently. I was invited out to CIA headquarters once to speak about Al-Qaeda codes and steganography, what kind of codes that Al-Qaeda might be using. So pretty much all over the place.
Very cool. I might have to have you come down to our university and give a talk.
I'd be happy to.
All right. Do you have any upcoming ones that you wanted to let anyone know or that are public information yet? Or do you have any scheduled?
I've got a list on my website, but most of the immediate upcoming ones are all going to be local to Missouri. But if anyone has a university and they want me to come out and speak, I'll come out and speak, no charge. Just let me know when and where.
Great, fantastic. I might take you up on that myself.
Okay.
We have to follow up on that after the show. Okay, wow, that's a lot. You know what, I honestly, not saying this to blow smoke, as the saying goes, but that's very impressive that you're willing to go out to high schools in particular. A lot of people don't want to present or don't want to go talk unless it's, you know, people go give presentations at a conference, but they wouldn't be willing to go to a high school or to something like that. That's very, I have a lot of respect for that. I'm very impressed to hear you say that. I go teach at like a local classes every once in a while or make some volunteer things here and there. And again, I don't charge for it or anything like that. And I think that's very, I'm very impressed by that. I have a lot of respect for that.
It's all about the community. Life and community, and it's all a tapestry, and we're all interwoven, and if someone wants to make things better, they have to be giving things back to the community. I believe that really strongly. I think a lot of people, and in the tech scene, and in all walks of life, I think people, when they get upset about something going on, they'll sit and complain about it, and they'll say, this sucks, this is bad, this shouldn't be that way. Well, it's easy to complain. It's hard to do something constructive and actually go out and try to change things in a positive way. And I strongly believe that if I feel like I'm not getting enough, then it's time for me to go out and be giving more and sharing information and talking to as many people as I can. And strangely enough, wherever I speak, there's people that show up and actually want to listen. So it seems to work all the way around.
Yeah, and I'm one of them. Yeah, I think that's very wise and very well said. I can't articulate it as cleanly as you can. When I try to make that same statement, there's a lot of F words and other foul language, but I agree with that wholeheartedly, and I've said that on the show. It's the simplest way I say it is I'll be rude. Quit bitching and do something about it. That's the way I tell. That's pretty much all I can say to people. So, well, as long as you're in the talking mood, let's move on into our main topic. And first of all, I would love to have you on the show, even if this wasn't the topic, because I think you do have a good grasp on a lot of different things. But let's talk about some cryptography. I can't even say the word. That's how bad I am.
Codes,
cryptography.
Codes.
Let's talk some codes tonight. How about that?
Okay.
And let's start off because, again, I'm going to freely admit that I've read a lot of this stuff, but to read terminology and to read it from a textbook standpoint is one thing, but to hear somebody break it down and explain it step by step in the thought process of something is something totally different. So will you indulge me to kind of come down to my level and answer some questions?
Sure. Okay.
I do. Let me see if we. I think let's bring everybody up to the same level here and start off. And let's do some basic terminology. And please let me just spit a couple out, and you correct me if I'm wrong or expand upon these. For example, I think a couple of the most basic terms that we should start off defining is clear text and ciphertext.
Okay, and those apply to most forms of encrypted communications. Not all, but most, yes.
And clear text would, of course, simply be the actual data. Like if I were to type out a letter to Alonka, an email to Alonka, or even write it down on, let's stick with paper, I write it down on a piece of paper.
Okay.
That's clear text, correct?
Correct.
It's that simple.
Also known as plain text.
Or plain text. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of redundant terminology, I think, in this, too, that confuses people. Now, ciphertext is the encrypted version of that, or the mixed-up, jumbled version of that?
Correct.
So, let's go with a very simple example that even I can follow. Let's go back to, like, when we were a kid, and you had that first thing you ever learned about, instead of writing out the letter, you could say, every time you want an A, you write the number 1. And every time you would a letter B, you write the number 2. And you could write out this stream of numbers. And the other person has to know that the 1 is A and 2 is B, et cetera, et cetera. And they can put that original message back together. So that all those numbers would be the cipher text, correct?
Correct.
And the resulting, the original, and then the resulting decoded version would be the clear text, which is the original message.
Correct.
Okay, so those two are fairly simple and fairly clear. The relationship between them, though, we didn't talk about or mention at all, and that's very important. I can make this ciphertext using some sort of algorithm or some sort of pattern, and this example, A equals 1, B equals 2, but the other person has to know that pattern or how I made that up.
And well, yes and no. If you want them to be able to read the message quickly, then yes, they should know what the pattern was.
So for this example of A equals 1, B equals 2, I would simply verbally tell them for this simple example.
Yeah.
Or they would know it ahead of time.
Right.
And that would, of course, I mean, would that be defined as the key?
Yes.
You'd have to give them a key of some sort or some kind of way to decode it.
Right. In that case, the key is the encryption method, yes.
The encryption method. Okay.
Right.
All right. So that's a very, very, very basic example. That's not exactly the practical use of it, however. That's the children's introduction, which is pretty much all I can handle.
Well, it's a good system, and systems like that and even simpler than that have been used for a long, long time and have been used in battlefield conditions. So not all codes have been very sophisticated. And also when you mentioned about plain text and ciphertext, I should mention that when you talk about codes, there's basically three different types of codes. And I may be getting into complex terms here, so stop me if I'm going too far out on the limb here. But the three types are what's called transposition, substitution, and concealment, meaning that there's three different ways of hiding a message. One is what the method you talked about, where you're taking each letter and you're substituting something else. In your case, you were substituting a number for the letter.
Okay, and that one is...
that's called a substitution cipher, is what you did.
Okay.
Now, another way of encrypting a message would be transposition, which is you take all the letters that are in your message, and you just mix them up. So all the same letters are there, but they're just in a different order. Like maybe you'd write them into a 5x5 rectangle and then read off the letters in columns instead of rows. So when someone's receiving the message, they're going to be getting all these letters that don't sound like anything, but if they write it back into that rectangle and then read it by rows instead of columns, then ta-da, there's the message. That's called a transposition cipher.
Interesting.
And a third system is called a concealment cipher. And that's where you take the message and it's there, it's just hidden in some way. If I'm not too far off on the tangent here, an old example of that was like from a few thousand years ago. There was a general that needed to send a message across enemy lines. Now, he knew that any messenger he sent was going to be searched. So how is he going to get a message across? Even if he would have encrypted the message, the messenger would have been searched, and the message would have been lost that way. Well, what the general did was he took a messenger, and he shaved the guy's scalp, and then he tattooed a message onto the guy's head. Mm. Then they waited for the guy's hair to grow back, and then they sent the messenger across the enemy lines. The messenger was sent. He was searched. No message was found. He gets across the other side. I'm not certain of this. I think he was trying to encourage a king to revolt or something. But the messenger gets across, shaves his head, points his head at the king, and the message gets across that way. So that would be an example of a concealment cipher. And there's a lot of other good examples of that.
Interesting. I had no idea. I didn't know there were names. All of those examples make perfect sense, but I had no idea that they were actually named and separate. And it sounds to me like I may be stepping off too far here, but you can mix and match those as well, correct?
Absolutely, and that makes things more and more secure and harder to crack.
Oh, I bet we're going to go into that later on, that's for sure. Okay, so, wow, that's... That already, I feel like I've learned a lot. I'm going to start, when I start looking at these more often, I'm going to start looking for different, what categories they fall in. That's going to help me understand stuff a lot better. What about, let's go back to some other simple terminology. Like, what's the difference between a cryptographer and a cryptanalyst?
Okay.
And which are you? And where do you fall under? We were joking about this earlier, but...
I'm all of them. If you break it down to, say, cryptography, it breaks down into the two roots, which is crypto and grapheme. Grapheme means to write, and crypto is from the word cryptos, which means it's Greek, and it means hidden. So cryptography means hidden writing. And cryptanalyst is someone who studies codes, is someone who analyzes the hidden things. And cryptology, I think logos, I think might be book. So again, a studier of codes or a studier of hidden things. There's also a type of steganography, or a type of code called steganography, which I was giving a talk on recently, which is it's a concealment cipher. It's a way of hiding messages inside of pictures. It's a modern form. And that comes from the root is stegos, which means covered or the roof. So steganography means covered writing or writing that's under a roof. And it's actually close to the word stegosaurus, which is it's stegosaurus, the lizard with a roof.
So yeah, I didn't even know. See, this is etymology and cryptography and a little history all rolled into one here. We should charge admission to this show. We should make this the one show that we charge people to listen. No, I'm just kidding. But all of this falls under just cryptography in general. So is it labeling the specific branches, I guess, if you will, inside of it seems a little... There's a lot of crossover. Like you said, you're a little bit of everything. You study all of that.
Right. I think the most commonly used term is really cryptography. And cryptography can be used in place of cryptology or cryptanalysis. Just saying cryptography is pretty much accepted.
And just cryptographer would be a person who's involved with these activities.
Correct.
So that's safe. Okay, that's a good term. All right. What about... Okay, how about... This is a... I don't even know how to define this. The word cipher.
Okay.
What is a cipher?
A cipher is it's a type of code. It's kind of a general term.
It's a generic, so it's not like cipher text. Cipher is not another way of saying cipher text necessarily?
Well, some people would say that there's a difference between codes and ciphers, that a cipher is a system. So what you were talking about where the A equals 1 and B equals 2, that is a cipher system, whereas a code would require something that's a code book. For example, that the word apple would mean airplane, and the word banana would mean battleship. And that's the kind where if you don't have the code book, when you get the ciphertext and you're going to see all these, you know, apple and banana, what are they saying?
Right.
You're not going to be able to understand it. Whereas with a cipher, you can basically encrypt any message as long as you're applying the algorithm of that cipher to the message. The Navajo code talkers from World War II, they tended to use codes. They had words that they used from the reservation, from the Navajo language, that represented different types of military technology. Though they also used some ciphers. They had an alphabet. Like we can say ABC, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot. They had and something similar to that that was in the Navajo language. And so they would say the words like rabbit. I don't remember exactly, but they could say a word which would actually mean the letter of the alphabet, and that would be a way that, and then they'd spell out a word using those symbols.
Hmm. Now, did you see the movie Wind Talkers?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I did not, so I'm completely, was it, you say that obviously as though you were not impressed.
they got some of the parts of what the Navajo Code Talkers did correct, but overall I thought the movie was not good. It was not good history. There were serious errors in it in terms of military tactics, and the whole plot line was just beyond fiction. It just would not have happened. It would never, ever have happened that to have a code talker that had a partner who had to kill him if the code talker was captured. It was just absurd.
yeah, well, two words.
Hollywood.
Yeah.
One word.
All right, we'll let that one go. I was going to say Nicolas Cage, but that's... Yeah. All right, so cipher then, I guess I probably incorrectly used the term key earlier. When cipher might have been, whatever the algorithm is to decode this stuff. So
No, in that case, you used it correctly. The key can be the algorithm that is used to decrypt something. And I've heard Ed Scheidt, who is the head of the CIA Cryptographic Center, who said basically that the key can sometimes be the algorithm,
okay.
The method.
So a key then could be the method, an algorithm, or it could be, I mean, would you still have a key, for example, let's go back to a new word I just learned, the transposition type. That is, like you used the example, I think, of making a square or a rectangle and reading it down instead of across.
Right.
Now, there's not really, I mean, is there really a key or cipher or anything in that? You just have to know the pattern. Is that still fall under key or?
Oh, sure. I could tell you that the key was 5, and you would know that you would need to make a 5x5 grid. Or I could tell you that the key was 27, and you'd know you needed to make a 27x27
right.
grid. Or I could tell you that the key was 5x8, and you'd know you needed to make a 5x8 grid.
Got you. Perfect sense. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Great. That's... I already have a whole lot more than I started this with. I think I just bumped the microphone. Sorry about that to the listeners. Now, the other thing is, all of this, I guess as computer people, as hackers, and as technophiles as we were, we always think of this in terms of computers and computer applications. But this is really based on, well, a lot of it on mathematics, but also historical application, like some of the stories you gave us earlier, but a lot of this is really based on mathematical formulas as far as getting a good cipher, if I'm using the terminology correctly. Is that right?
Modern codes absolutely require computers, yeah. The length of the keys involved, the quantity of manipulations of data that are required, it's just not feasible to do it pencil and paper, though it's possible. I mean, the simplest thing is, just look at computers, and a lot of your listeners will be aware of this, is binary. Each time, say, the letter A appears on the screen, there's a hexadecimal value of that, which might be like 6-1, and then a binary representation of that, which would be 0110001. And that's how computers talk, is with zeros and ones. It's a square wave. It's a 5-volt square wave, if I'm remembering correctly.
I am impressed that you knew the binary for the letter A. I'm giving you some applause. That was good. That was good stuff.
I went to the St. Louis 2600 meeting once, and somebody had a T-shirt there that was all in binary. And I asked him, did it say something, or was it just random ones and zeros? He says, no, it says something. I say, okay, don't tell me what it says. And I didn't have a computer, didn't have a palm pile, I had nothing. I just sat there with pencil and paper and just read off what his shirt said.
Yeah.
And it's once you know a couple kind of signposts in binary, it is possible to do with pencil and paper. Slowly, definitely a computer could have done it much more quickly than I could, but it is possible to do it with pencil and paper.
Yeah, you can, if it's done properly, I can do some in my head, some short ones. If it gets longer than that, my memory runs out. I don't have enough RAM. I can do them in my head. And also, you even got the 0100 at the beginning. That's also important because the full binary is 8-bit. But we'll go, that's a whole separate, that's a whole separate thing there. Very good, very good. All right, so
but basically, letters to binary, that's a substitution cipher right there. You're substituting a letter for some other symbol or group of symbols, and that's a code right there.
Now, but more to the point, as far as modern day, like all those things that we've mentioned before, almost every one of them, you can sit down with a pencil and paper and figure out. I mean, almost everything that we've mentioned so far. Even if it wasn't A equals 1, B equals 2, let's say it was I started with T equals whatever and J equals that, there are ways you can sit down and brute force that with your own mind, pencil and paper, trial and error, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, as far as application, some of those, I don't know the word, fundamental, or some of those base concepts have to be put into a real-world application, because you have to make it difficult enough that somebody can't do it in their head.
Correct.
And that's why computers become important in the whole thing. So, and I guess, and maybe you can put this in the words better than I can again also, but the key to the whole thing and the most important way to make a strong cipher or a strong encryption algorithm or whatever is there's a relationship there with prime numbers is what I'm getting at. And I don't know exactly how to put that in words, but a large prime number is not something that somebody can decode or break down in their head.
Right. If you have... And this is PGP RSA encryption. If you have big prime, I mean big, like I'm talking like 100 digits long number, and you take two prime numbers that are like that, and you multiply them together, and then you present that number, it's going to be very difficult for a human being to take that resulting product and figure out which primes put it together. And that's basically the origin of some of this, the public key encryption that's out there, is that they're encrypted with numbers that have been derived with computers that did some very advanced mathematical processing to come up with these.
Theoretically,
a human could do it, but think how hard it is just to multiply two seven-digit numbers together. Making a lot of columns. If you've got 200-digit numbers and you're multiplying them together, it's going to take a lot of paper and a lot of pencil lead, and you're going to be at it for a long time. And you're going to need to do this over and over and over and over again as you go on through the messages.
Right. So I was even going to go simpler than that. I was two prime numbers. So let's say 7 and 11.
Okay.
Now you multiply those, you get 77.
Okay.
You and I can both, and most anybody listening to the show, can work backwards from 70, given 77, and figure out how did you get 77. Well, there's only two factors, 7 and 11, and those two do not break down because they're already prime numbers.
Right.
7 and 11. And then, like you said, you take it to 4, 5, 7, 10, 50-digit numbers. Obviously, that's when you need a computer. Well, okay, well, let's back up to the mathematics part of it. Simply said, a 50-digit prime number is going to be faster and easier for a computer to break down to primes. A 50-digit number would be easier to break down to primes than, say, a 500-digit prime number.
Correct.
Logically, common sense means that, right?
Correct.
So, I may be stretching. By all means, if there is a listener out there who can confirm this for me, email and let me know. But I guess I'm taking that a step further to say if we have a key length of 50 digits or 50 characters. I'm thinking like a password. If it's a 5-character password and you have a 10-character password, it's going to be a lot more effective. It's going to be more difficult to break that password. Same thing with an encrypted file or something of that matter. If the key length is 50 characters or however many, you get talking into bits, actually. The numbers are so big with the computing power these days that the bigger the key length, the bigger the key size, then the harder it is for it to crack. But yeah, that may be taking a big leap for me, so maybe I should back away from that a little bit. But it is, now, that is where the crossover comes, is it is fundamentally a mathematics thing, a pattern matching thing. I don't know, thing is not exactly a great word to use here, but I don't have much better. A thing that's fundamentally based in mathematics and patterns and logic to come up with some of this stuff. However, you mix in these large numbers, that's when the computer comes in, and that's why we see cryptography used in so many computer applications, because the computers are the only ones that can break down these numbers in such a way to keep them safe so that only another computer can break them down, and only somebody else with a computer with the proper key can make use of them, even if they intercepted it. Now, where do we see a lot? I mean, we see this in computers a lot these days. Where's some place that people will see this kind of thing used? I mean, obviously, like, what, ATMs?
Well, when you're talking like the prime number encryption, that would be used if someone has, like, the PGP software, and they're
right.
sending email messages back and forth that are encrypted with PGP. That's going to be involving some of this prime number stuff. Then there's
right.
other modern encryption systems, and yes, an ATM. Every time you put your card into an ATM machine, that data is going to be encrypted and sent around, and there's constant wires. The banks are constantly talking to each other all across the world and sending money back and forth. And of course, they're not sending it in an actual bag with gold pieces in it. They're saying, okay, we're deducting $50,000 on this end, and you're going to be increasing $50,000 on your side, and here's the proof that I've done it on my side, and that you give me the verification you've done it from your side, and all of that has to be very secure so that no one else is going to tap in and say, okay, I'm just telling you I'm deducting $50,000 on my side. You increase $50,000 on your side, and I'll swing by and I'll pick it up later.
Yeah.
And that way they're kind of manufacturing money, and you don't want to have that done. So the banks use very, very secure systems of talking back and forth to each other, and all of that is encrypted.
I stuff what little bit of money I have in my mattress. I don't all these computer technology, these newfangled interweb things, now that confuses me. I'm old fashioned. All right. Well, you know what? Can I break down and just ask some? Can I just ask you some questions?
Sure.
Just some freestyle, because how did you get interested in this? What brought you? You said you're a game developer. How did you get in? I mean, do you apply this into any of your game developing stuff, or how did you even get interested in this in the first place?
Into codes?
Into codes and cryptography.
I've been interested in codes forever. I mean, I was interested in puzzles, I think, before I could even read. My mother would tell stories of putting me down on the back doorstep with a jigsaw puzzle. I'd be happy for hours. And then as I grew up, I think there was a neighborhood boy who was studying codes for a Boy Scout merit badge, I think, and I was just over at his house all the time, and I was asking questions and reading his books, and he finally just gave me all of his books on codes. But then to get into the public scene, where I'm now doing the public speaking, that came out because of the convention Dragon Con down in Atlanta. I was there, and I was speaking on games and game development, and I was speaking in Dragon Con, for those of your listeners who aren't familiar with it, it's a massive fan convention down in Atlanta. It gets tens of thousands of people, and they organize the convention in tracks, so there will be like a Star Wars track and a Buffy the Vampire Slayer track and a comic books track and a British sci-fi track. And one of the tracks was a Electronic Frontiers Forum. And in this track, there will be several different talks on things related to the tech scene and also things related to the online gaming scene. And so I would be there speaking about my games and other things relating to the whole online game industry. And that's also where some of the hackers were coming in. The SE2600 from Tennessee and Georgia were coming in, and they'd be speaking about computer security. And so I kind of got to know them that way. This was back in, I think, 1999, 2000. And I'd see them in the halls. We'd have a beer at the end of the day, that kind of thing. And it was through them that I'd heard about a code that had been released at one of the HackerCons, Freaknik, in Nashville, Tennessee. And there was a code, it was called the Freaknik 3 code, and it had been released as a challenge to the people at the Freaknik convention, and with a prize offered to the first person to crack the code. Well, when I heard about this, it had been a year, and no one had cracked the code yet. A lot of people had tried, but no one had figured it out. And so I kind of picked up the flyers at Dragon Con and then went off and did my thing, came back to St. Louis. And then I was really bored one weekend. I think I was homesick with the flu. And I picked up the flyers and just kind of started looking at it. And I got really obsessed with it. And I decided to make a go of it. And I got totally, it just consumed my life for 10 days. I could do little else than work on this code. And I'd be dumping Scrabble tiles and moving tiles around on the table and reading things on the Internet and talking to lots of people. Pretty much anyone of my friends that came to say, hey, Lonka, you want to do this? I'm like, don't talk to me unless you want to talk about this code. But the obsession worked because I cracked the code. And
yeah, but
I got to the center, and it was kind of a funny center because the the guy that had written the code, a hacker by the name of Johnny X, is a DJ in Nashville, he had not made the assumption that the code might be cracked by a woman, and so there was something kind of sexist in the middle of it. It was, when you've gotten to the center of the code, what you need to do is to announce your win. You need to go to the hacker mailing list. It was the current SE2600 mailing list, and he said, you need to post a message in haiku or sonnet format, explaining why you like to go swimming with bow-legged women.
Okay.
And I'm working, it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I get there, and I need to do what? But
what?
I came up with something. Do you want to hear the haiku?
Is it going to give it away, though? What if our listeners...
No.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
It was, haiku is, you know, it's a three-line poem that's a certain number of syllables, five syllables, seven syllables, and five syllables.
Right.
And so the haiku that I wrote was, Johnny X and I will discuss things aquatic if he wears a suit. And so I posted that message to the list, and it took him a month to reply, but he finally did, and I won the prize, which was a free trip to a HackerCon and free T-shirts and free drinks. Not that it's hard to get free drinks at a HackerCon, but anyway.
Or free cookies if you're around.
There you go, free cookies.
I was having your cookies.
And I went around cracking some other codes, other challenges, and I actually cracked so many that when the AtlantaCon, HackerCon, when they released their code challenge, it was on a sheet of paper, and at the bottom of the paper it said, note, past puzzle crackers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving the AtlantaCon puzzle, give someone else a chance, Ilanka.
But you know what? Now, joking aside, let's back up because you kind of skipped an important part of that story.
Okay.
Truthfully, you said you found this on the website. You were home with the flu. You became obsessed with it. And I think you yada yadded over it. You basically said one thing led to another, and I found. No, I need to know. I need to know the yada yada. I need to know the one thing led to another. You took a. I think you said I took a shot at it. Okay. If somebody's okay. I get a piece of paper with a bunch of what equates to gibberish. It's just a bunch of garbage on there. Now, if I saw something that was maybe a couple digits transposed, or like for example, spaces in between parts of it, I would think, okay, those are probably words. If I see a three-letter word, it might be the, and I could start working backwards from that, you know, kind of reverse engineer it.
That's excellent. That's an excellent way of going at it.
That's not the way this works. These are like a continuous stream of garbage at this point. When you're first looking at, you're looking at this, and you don't, it's a foreign language. You don't know what you're looking at. Honestly, where do you begin? How do you look at that and say, okay, I want to crack this? What I mean, do you look for patterns in the sequence? Do you look for certain characters?
Well, first of all, just in case any of your listeners are curious about it, I can show them a link where they can actually see the code. And I think you've also got a tiny URL set up. But the code, last I checked, was online at the freaknik.org website, though that may be down. So what was the tiny URL that you had set up?
The Freaknik 3. See, we plan ahead on this show. The Freaknik 3 Challenge. And this is something that basically the original project, the original code is up there, and it has a step-by-step walkthrough of how to solve it as well, right?
Yes.
So the listeners can go to this, take a shot at themselves, and then follow and get some hints or see how it's done. This is a great learning tool here. I did make a tiny URL of it at 658, C as in candy, A as in apple. Hey, candy apple. 658CA.
Okay.
And that'll take
you to it. And the original code is at the URL, which is the www.freaknik.org. Freaknik is spelled P-H-R-E-A-K-N-I-C. So www.freaknik.org/freaknik.txt, T-X-T. And there you can see the Freaknik code in its blocky glory there. Now, assuming that your listeners are doing this, and I'm looking at it on my screen, I'm not sure if you're looking at it on your screen, but when I looked at it, I could see that, though it did just look like garbage, that if you look at it a little longer, you can see that there's different kinds of garbage there. And
okay.
Like the first line is a bunch of numbers. And then the lines 2 through 4 are just like you were describing, how it looks like they're sort of words and spaces and punctuation.
All right, actually, let's do this. You know, some people are going to rewind and listen to this again with it in front of them. So this is okay. A good exercise. It was freaknik.org/...
Freaknik.txt, but you need to put it's www because they don't have it enabled for without the www.
Okay, that's fine. I'm looking at it right now with you, and okay. Anybody who, if you're listening to this live, you can go download this and listen to it at your convenience. Pause it as necessary and follow along with some of this. This is because
okay.
I can't. Okay,
right,
I see
looking
this.
At the top line and you see all the letters and numbers, right?
Okay, yes.
All right, and lines 2 through 4, and you can see it's kind of broken up and it's got. Like words and spaces and commas and punctuation.
Yes, I see that.
Okay, and then there's like a whole mess, which is letters and a few punctuation symbols. And then there's another 8 lines, which is a different kind of mess, because now you have different kinds of punctuation symbols. There's lots of at signs in there, and it's more punctuation than letters.
Right. That's...
And then there's a couple lines with dashes, and then there's the line at the end has a bunch of just B's and K's.
Right.
Okay, so like I looked at the B's and K's and I thought, okay, all it is like BKK, BBK, BKB, KKB, and it's like, well, what kind of a code would only have 2 possible states?
Binary.
Binary, ta-da.
Really?
Right there.
Did I get that right?
And so that's what I did is I converted, I think, all the B's to zeros and all the K's to ones, and I counted things and it was all evenly divisible by 8, and I'm like, aha, okay. And it's a HackerCon, so there's going to be something high-tech in there.
Hmm.
And then now that you know the last line may be binary, if you look at the first line again, and you can see it's mostly numbers, but
it's
it has
hex.
Some letters. It has the letter E, the letter A, the letter D, but nothing higher than an F
than
in
an
the
F,
alphabet.
So that's, gotcha, so that's hexadecimal.
Bingo.
Okay.
All right, which is another, again, a substitution cipher where you're taking 2-digit numbers where each 2-digit number is standing for a particular letter. And I won't go through the entire code here, but I can probably talk for a couple hours on that. But that's how I started, as I broke it down into the different sections of garbage that it had. The lines 2 through 4, where it sort of looks like words, that'll come apart to a very common cryptanalysis technique called frequency. Counting, frequency analysis, which is that you take any message and you count every letter and you see how many occurrences of each letter are there. And then if you see that there's certain letters that there's a lot more of than other letters, then chances are that they will be substitutes for the letters that are the most frequently used letters in the English language.
Like S or T or...
Yeah, the most frequently used letter in the English language is the letter E.
E, okay.
And the second most frequently used letter is the letter T. So if you do a frequency analysis on a message and you see that there's a whole bunch of 1 or 2 letters, chances are pretty good that those are going to be E and T. And then you can substitute there, and then you can start looking, okay, so if an E falls at the end of a 3-letter word and the T falls at the beginning of that 3-letter word, there's a good chance that the middle letter is going to be an H.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and just keep whittling at it, I did what I'm describing. I kind of went at it piece by piece, and I also showed it to people. And I would go to the smartest people I knew, and I would say, "What do you see?" And they would look at it, and they would scratch their head, and they'd say, "I don't know, but hey, that sort of looks like UU encoding." And at that point, I said, "What's UU encoding?" I'd never heard of UU encoding in my life, but I go on the web. And I type in UU encoding, and I read up about UU encoding, and I read about the algorithm, and I look for UU decoders, and then I would take from the Freaknik code, and I chopped it up, and I put it into a UU decoder, and
right.
came out with nothing. And then I'm like, okay, well, why didn't it come out? And then I started reading more about formatting, and then I formatted things in different ways, and there's some ROT13 in there, which is an old newsgroup encryption method, which basically just takes each letter and moves it 13 letters away in the alphabet. So an A becomes an N, a B becomes an O, a C becomes a P, and it's a rotation of exactly 13. And the reason 13 is a great number to use is because the alphabet has 26 letters in it. So an A becomes an N, and an N becomes an A. It's a reverse. It always comes back to the same thing. A B becomes an O, and an O becomes a B. So it's a very simple way of moving things around.
Okay, so this is really interesting. This is really a good sample to start for people to play with, because I'm glancing at it now too, and I see some patterns now. Like I see 644 jumps out at me towards the end, and there's a dot in there that symbolizes some sort of file name. And
exactly.
You can start really doing, okay, I see you can break this down into parts now, and I never really thought about or never really seen any like this. This is a good example. But let's take this. That's something that this is a good way of making me see it. I understand that. I hope the listeners understand or see this a little bit better too. But that is a simple example. I mean, it's not simple, but that is a prepared one for computers and techies and stuff like that. Let's take it up a notch, as they say. How do you then go to this Cyrillic projector? Okay? No. How do you then go to a Cyrillic projector, which is in a different language and in some kind of encrypted format that you don't have a clue, so you can't... See, here you're saying we acknowledge certain patterns, like possible binary and hex codes and file names and ROT13, stuff that's familiar to us. What about stuff that's not familiar to you? How do you notice a pattern, or how do you notice... Where do you start with something like the Cyrillic projector? Not that our listeners may necessarily jump into that with their first one, but...
Okay. Well, I heard... Let me back up a little bit, and how did I hear about the Cyrillic projector?
Okay.
I heard about the Cyrillic projector. It's actually through the Freaknik 3 code, because when Johnny X wrote the Freaknik 3 code, he put in a bunch of dead ends. And one of those dead ends says, go to the CIA website and go solve this. And he gave a link to a picture of a sculpture at the center of CIA, which is called the Crypto Sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a red herring. It was a dead end in the Freaknik code. But it was through that I first heard about Kryptos, and I started reading about Kryptos. And Kryptos is a sculpture that was created as a challenge to the employees at the CIA. It's a big wavy screen about 12 feet tall, about 20 feet long. It looks sort of like a sheet of paper that's coming out of a printer on its side.
Let me interrupt just to clarify, because for radio, Kryptos is not a term. I don't want to confuse it with cryptography. It's a proper name. Kryptos, name of this particular statue or this particular thing. This, I don't want to confuse it with any terminology here.
Well, it is actually, because crypto comes from the Greek word kryptos, which means hidden. And the name of the sculpture is, that's the word. It's named after the Greek word kryptos.
But it is referring to the sculpture itself.
Yes.
And in this case, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And it was commissioned in 1988, installed in 1990, and it has characters that are punched through the metal of this wall on the sculpture. There's about 2,000 characters, and there's some other pieces around the CIA grounds that are related with Morse code and a compass, but the primary piece is this crypto sculpture with the letters. And what we've learned is that there's four codes that we know of that are on this sculpture. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth one has not been solved, and it's considered to be one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. It's in the top 10. On my list, I think I have it at number 5. Hmm. And so I became intrigued with Kryptos that way. I tried to get in to CIA once to see Kryptos, and I got turned away by really big guys with guns who said I couldn't get in unless I had official business. And then later I did get in on official business when I was speaking about Al-Qaeda codes and steganography. And that's when I had a chance to see the crypto sculpture up close. And then I made some rubbings of it, and I posted them on a web page. And then my life began to change, because all of a sudden I'm an expert on Kryptos, and people are writing to me from all over the world with questions and observations about Kryptos. We formed a mailing list, and I have an FAQ that I maintain, and people keep asking me other questions about Kryptos. Well, one of the questions that came up was, who made Kryptos? The answer to that is a man named James Sanborn. He's still living. He lives in Washington, D.C. And another question was, what other sculptures has Sanborn done? Has he made any other sculptures with codes on them? And the answer is yes. After he made Kryptos, which is in the CIA, I found out that he made another sculpture called the Cyrillic Projector, which is related to KGB codes. Right. This sculpture was, he used it in some shows, art gallery shows here and there, and then he sold it to the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, and that's where the Cyrillic projector sits right now, is on the campus of the Charlotte University there. So one of the things that my group did, because we've now got a group of about 300 people from all over the world that are working really hard on cracking that part four on Kryptos. And if any of your listeners want to get involved, then come on in.
Wow.
I'll take all the ideas that we can get.
Yeah, and you know what? And actually, I hate to do this. We're kind of running low here. Maybe we can go into a show one day and go through a detailed look at this actual project.
Sure.
And some of the things that you have found. I hate to cut you off because this is, we could go on for hours and hours. I'll sit here and listen to you after the show's over for hours about this, but I'm afraid if we get started on this, we've got 7, 8, 9 minutes left, and I don't know if we're going to be able to.
Okay, let me do a quick thing then on the projector about how we solved it. And there were a lot of people involved. It definitely wasn't a solo project of my own, but we transcribed it, and then we looked at the methods, and the key in that case was what type of cipher was it. And there's a type of cipher called a visionaire cipher, which is made by a French cryptographer a few hundred years ago. And there is a visionaire table. It's a table system where you make a table in a certain format, and then you apply the plain text to the table and come out with ciphertext. Well, there was a table right on the sculpture, so that was a big clue that the ciphertext on the sculpture was probably encrypted with a visionaire method. But it wasn't that simple, of course. There was a single keyword, double keyword methods, and there was an extra twist in there, and I agree that's a whole other story. But the methods that were used to encrypt the Cyrillic projector were similar to the methods that were used to encrypt Kryptos. And that was another thing that helped us along. We looked at what Sanborn had learned about codes when he did Kryptos, and then we saw that he had applied some of that to the Cyrillic projector. And it's a much longer story, but that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, and I know you laughed at this when I said this before, but I also respect the fact that not only was this a more complex code, and you started off with less of, you know, with the computer one, you had some familiarity with the stuff, especially some of us listening to this show. But with this one, you start off with nothing or very little, and you have to do a lot of research to try to find what it could be in patterns. But the thing that really blew my mind was when I read through, I went through your slides from the last DEF CON where you talked about this, and I looked through your website, and I do understand now how the patterns work and how you can find stuff. But my gosh, when I saw that you guys somehow found out, I mean, what do you do when you think you've got the pattern and you've got it and it's starting to look right and you find out that there's a spelling error in there? How do you find a pattern? Let's go back to my simple example of A equals 1, B equals 2. If somebody messes up 6 or 7 of those, it throws you all off. I mean, if there's a mistake in there, that would drive me insane. It drives me insane thinking about it.
Well, nearly every code that I have cracked, every single one, has had spelling errors in it.
Oh, somebody should be slapped for that.
No, it's not saying anything about the tech scene. Even the Edgar Allan Poe ciphers. I mean, every code that I have seen, the Zodiac Killer ciphers, everything, there are errors in it. Because humans, we screw up. We make mistakes. And one of the ways that I think that I have cracked some codes that other people have not is because I keep that in mind. I keep it in mind that when I'm looking at ciphertext, it may not be perfect. It probably is not perfect. It was probably encrypted by a human who screwed something up. And I think about the ways that they could have screwed things up. And then I look for those mistakes.
Yeah,
and often that's the way that I find the way into the code.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And also, could they have been intentionally put in there as a red herring to throw people off?
In some cases, yes. I think in most cases, it's just an honest mistake. Like the crypto sculpture at CIA, there are three, in the three parts that we've solved so far, there are spelling errors. And two of them, really briefly, part one, the plain text of part one says, between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of occlusion. Now, we think that it's supposed to say illusion, but it says occlusion. It's spelled I-Q-L-U-S-I-O-N. Well, there's no such word as occlusion. And I've asked, I had dinner with Sanborn, the artist, and I asked him, was that a mistake or was it deliberate? And he said it was deliberate. But then he also said something really interesting. He said that one was deliberate, and he said there was another one where the word underground was spelled with two U's instead of an O-U. And he said, but it's not what those errors are that is so important. He says it's not what they are that's important, it's where they are. It's their orientation or their positioning.
Uh-huh.
And we've had lots and lots of discussion about that comment of his, but we still don't know what it means. But there's another typo on the sculpture, which is the word desperately is misspelled. And when I asked him about that, he gave a different answer, which I asked him if it was deliberate, and he said it's possible, anything's possible, which I think is Sanborn speak for it. That one was a real mistake. But I don't know that for sure.
Gosh, and now you're mixing. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know what? I think that is going to have to be. Please come back for another show sometime.
I'd be happy
to. I know it's so hard to get in touch with you, and we've been trying to work this out. We've definitely got to do another episode and go into some detail on these projects and maybe even start looking at some of your other top 10, which, by the way, let's pimp your site, which is elonka.com, ELONKA.com. And that'll link to some of the AOL stuff, some of the Freaknik stuff, your presentations, particularly the one page on there, unsolvedcodes.html, capital U, capital C, but that you link from elonka.com, they'll find it there. For anybody that wants to take a look at some of these, do you have some of these set, like if and when? Well, I'm not going to say if. When you finish up with the Cyrillic projector, are you going to move on to like another? Are you going to pick another one off that list and... They just start with number one. And
that I don't have to be the person to solve cryptos. I just want to see cryptos solved. I want it off my plate. So if I can do that by public speaking and teaching as many people as I can about cryptos and just making it as public as possible so that someone else solves it, that is fine with me.
Awesome. Well, hey, maybe some of the listeners will be motivated to put a group together themselves or take some stabs at it on their own.
Sure.
If they're like me, if they're going to...
Completely fine. As a matter of fact, that's kind of how the Cyrillic projector was solved. It was multiple people who were working, but some of them had no idea of the existence of others. It's a really interesting story.
Great. Well, hopefully that works out here. Well, let's wrap up the show here. We always wrap up the show with a couple little things to kind of tidy it out. Give shout-outs at the end of the show. And I'll give you a couple seconds to think if there's anyone you want to say hi to. I'm going to say hi to Andrew Grieg. We mentioned him in that article earlier about the PDA and all the great stuff he's doing. I think that's phenomenal. And, again, love to see somebody doing, not talking, but doing stuff. Shouts to Nick84. He sent me a video that I was wanting. I wasn't able to record, so he sent me a video I've been wanting. So thanks to him. And to the Obtruse One, is that abstract and obtruse mixed together? The Obtruse One for confirming that dating game thing we were talking about earlier. So he also sent me an email about it. And to DC305, the Miami DEF CON, New Hack City. Shouts out to everybody from the DEF CON group. And Elonka, anybody you want to give shout-outs to?
Oh, gosh, there's so many people that have helped me with these codes. I'm going to do a big general shout-out to the Midwest 2600 group and everyone that's helped me, whose name I may not be remembering, especially Andy. He's been invaluable over the years. And usually when I'm talking about codes, he's usually the first person that I go to for help.
Okay. Sounds good. And shouts out to the Atlanta 2600 guys, Decius and Acidus and those guys. Always give them shout outs whenever I can. I know that we are mutual friends of ours. And Elonka, to you, thank you for coming on. And honestly, you know, we met at Freaknik and again through some mutual friends. And you were probably, I have to say, you were the nicest person I met there. I mean that sincerely.
Aww.
And I'm not trying to get you back on the show. I wish you would, but I honestly. I'm kind of corny that way. I really want to tell you that you were very nice to me there because I was a total stranger to you. And I had a good time. I thought you were a very well-mannered, very nice person. And I got to say that you were the nicest person that I met at Freaknik. And I hope we can meet up again at some of these other conferences.
Sure, so it would be my pleasure. Absolutely. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show.
Oh, we have fun. We laugh a little bit. We don't make it too awful serious, but we do cover some good stuff. So thank you for being on. To the listeners, you guys all know, guys and girls, I caught myself, guys and girls, know you can all email us to radio@benrev.com. Feedback on any of the stuff we've talked about or follow-ups or anything like that. Will you field some questions or put some people to... in touch if they want to get involved in the group and join on, like you said earlier?
Oh, they got it. Yeah, we have a Yahoo group. They can join anytime they want.
Great. So feel free to send it to me, and I'll forward it on if necessary, radio@benrev.com, or you can follow up, as Elonka just said, that information. Our closing music this week is from It actually was sent in by a listener, and it's somebody, it's DJ BC, and he has an album called The Beastles, which, if you think about it for a second, it's actually, I guess they call them mashes. It's a mix of The Beatles and The Beastie Boys, thus The Beastles. So this is a track from there that I liked a lot. I think this is the second track off the album. Not sure which one I was picking. And that is going to do it. We're going to wrap it up. Episode 78 in the books. Again, Alanka, thank you for being on the show. And to all our listeners, we tell them the same thing we tell them every week, that we will see them next week, same hack time.
Same hack channel.
Somewhere in the ancient Trinity, you get three as a magic.